A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He's been thinking about punctuation history since we talked about silent reading and those old scripts that ran without any marks at all. He wants to know whether English punctuation has actually contracted over time, whether the marks we think of as standard emerge gradually or all at once, and there's a personal grievance in here too. Apparently, he's been using them dashes for years, and now they're being flagged as proof of AI-generated text, which he finds irritating.
And the question is better than most people realize, because the story most of us got in school, that punctuation is this fixed system handed down by grammarians, is almost entirely wrong. What actually happened is messier and much more interesting.
By the way, today's episode is powered by DeepSeek V4 Pro.
Welcome aboard, DeepSeek. Now, punctuation, where do you even start with something that's literally invisible when it's working?
That's the thing, isn't it? You only notice it when it fails. A missing comma changes a meaning, and suddenly you're parsing a sentence three times. But most people never think about where any of this came from.
The real answer is that punctuation emerged over about 2,000 years, from multiple places, for completely different reasons, and the set we use today is radically smaller than what was available even 200 years ago. So yes, Daniel's contraction instinct is correct. The inventory shrank enormously.
Let's start with the zero punctuation world then. What did text actually look like?
Imagine a block of capital letters with no spaces between words, no periods, no commas, nothing. This is called scriptio continua, and it was the standard in classical Greek and Latin for centuries. You'd have something like Thaisa's esentence, and do you have topper's eye by rating it aloud?
Which connects directly to what we discussed before. Reading aloud was the decoding mechanism. Your voice found the boundaries your eyes couldn't see.
The earliest punctuation marks weren't for readers at all. They were performance annotations for orators. Aristophanes of Byzantium, around 200 BCE, working at the Library of Alexandria, invented a system of three dots placed at different heights to indicate how long a speaker should pause. A dot at the top of the line, the periodos, marked a full stop. A dot in the middle, the colon, was a medium pause. A dot at the bottom, the comma, was a short breath.
The comma and the colon are literally named after breathing patterns. That's wonderful.
The period literally means a completed circuit, a full cycle. But here's the key thing. These marks were for reading aloud for public speaking. They weren't grammatical. They were rhythmic, almost musical.
When does that shift? When does punctuation become about meaning rather than breathing?
The big inflection point is the shift from scroll to codex, from world manuscripts to bound books, between the 2nd and 4th centuries. Once you have a codex, you can flip pages, you can reference things non-linearly, and suddenly silent reading becomes more common. Punctuation starts migrating from performance cues to comprehension aids.
It's still not standardized. We're not talking about a system anyone agreed on.
Throughout the medieval period, punctuation was wildly inconsistent. Every scriptorium had its own conventions. Irish monks in the 7th and 8th centuries, and this is one of my favorite details, they're the ones who introduced word spacing into Latin manuscripts. They were copying texts in a language that wasn't their native tongue, and they needed the visual help parsing words, so they just started putting spaces between them.
Irish monks invented the space bar. That feels like something that should be on a t-shirt.
It genuinely changed everything. Word spacing made silent reading possible at scale. Before that, even literate people mostly read aloud or at least murmured. After spacing, you could scan silently, which is faster and, crucially, private. Your reading became your own.
We've got dots for pauses, we've got spaces, we've got monks experimenting. Where does the modern system actually crystallize?
The printing press. And one name in particular, Aldus Manutius, a Venetian printer working in the 1490s and early 1500s. He's the one who really systematized punctuation for print. His typefaces included the comma, the period, the colon, the semicolon, which he essentially invented or at least popularized, and the question mark.
Let's pause on the semicolon. Daniel mentioned it as one of those idiosyncratic choices. What was Minutius actually trying to do with it?
He wanted something between a comma and a colon, a pause that's stronger than a comma but doesn't fully separate two independent clauses the way a period would. And he used it extensively in his editions of classical texts. The semicolon was born as a tool for managing complex, multi-clause sentences, the kind of sentence structure that was fashionable in Renaissance Latin and Italian.
Which means the semicolon was always a bit of a luxury item. It's for sentences that are already architecturally ambitious.
And that's why it's been controversial for 500 years. People have been arguing about semicolons since semicolons existed. Kurt Vonnegut famously said the only thing a semicolon proves is that you went to college. But I think that's unfair. It's a tool for expressing a specific logical relationship between thoughts, and when it works, nothing else quite does the same job.
I use them sparingly. They feel like a spice that overpowers the dish if you're not careful.
That's a reasonable position. Now, Minutius also gave us the modern comma. He took Aristophanes' breathing marks and turned them into the curved symbol we recognize. And his typefaces included the first italic type, which he used partly as a space-saving measure, but which also created a visual distinction between emphasis and body text.
One Venetian printer in the 1490s basically defined what English punctuation would look like for the next five centuries.
Not just English. His convention spread across European printing. But here's where Daniel's question about contraction gets really interesting. The punctuation inventory of the 17th and 18th centuries was enormous compared to today.
Give me examples. What did we lose?
The percontation point, a backwards question mark proposed in the 1580s by Henry Denham, an English printer, specifically for rhetorical questions. The idea was that a rhetorical question isn't really a question, so it shouldn't use the same mark. It never caught on widely, but it was used in some printed works for a few decades.
I actually love that. There's a real difference between what time is it and who really knows what time it is. Having a mark for that distinction makes sense.
Then there's the irony mark. Proposed multiple times throughout history, most notably by the French poet Alcantar de Brame in the late 19th century. He suggested a mark that looked like a backwards question mark to indicate that a sentence should be read with ironic intent.
Which would solve approximately 40% of internet arguments.
And there have been serious proposals for an irony mark as recently as the 2010s, but none of them stuck. And that's the pattern. People keep inventing punctuation marks to solve specific communicative problems, and almost all of them failed to be adopted.
What about marks that actually did exist in common use, and then died?
The pilcro, the paragraph mark, that backwards P symbol. It was once used in virtually every manuscript and early printed book to mark paragraph breaks. Over time, it migrated to the margins, then disappeared entirely from running text. Now, it's mostly a formatting tool in word processors.
The dagger and double dagger, the obelus and desis. Those were once common in general writing, not just academic footnotes.
In the 18th century, you'd see daggers used to mark dubious passages or to indicate a footnote. Now they're almost exclusively used for death dates in biographies and for statistical significance in academic papers. The usage contracted dramatically.
What drove the contraction? Why did English punctuation shrink rather than expand?
A few forces working together. One is the rise of prescriptive grammar in the 18th century. Bishop Robert Loth's grammar in 1762, Lindley Murray's grammar in 1795. These books tried to codify correct English, and part of that project was simplifying and standardizing punctuation.
The grammarians as gatekeepers.
They were effective. The 19th century saw a further push toward standardization through mass education. When you're teaching millions of children to read and write, you need a system that's teachable. A smaller set of rules is easier to transmit than a sprawling inventory of special case marks.
Standardization was partly a pedagogical decision, not a linguistic one.
And then the typewriter delivered another blow. Most typewriters had a very limited character set. You got a period, a comma, a colon, a semicolon, a question mark, an exclamation point, quotation marks, apostrophes, parentheses, and hyphens. That's about it. No M dash, no N dash, no ellipsis as a single character.
People made do. Two hyphens became a dash. Three periods became an ellipsis.
Those workarounds became conventions in their own right. But the typewriter keyboard essentially froze the punctuation inventory for a century. Even after word processors gave us access to a much wider character set, the habits were set.
This brings us to Daniel's M-dash grievance. Let's talk about that directly, because it's a fascinating case study in how punctuation becomes culturally loaded.
The M-dash has been around since the 18th century. It's named because it's roughly the width of the letter M in a given typeface. It's used to indicate a break in thought, an interruption, or a parenthetical that's more emphatic than parentheses. And for most of its history, it was just another tool in the writer's kit.
Then large language models arrived, and suddenly the M-dash became a tell.
There's been a lot of discussion about this in writing and editing circles over the past couple of years. AI-generated text, particularly from certain models, uses M-dashes much more frequently than most human writers do. Not because the AI likes M-dashes, but because its training data, formal writing, journalism, academic prose, uses them at a certain rate, and the model reproduces that pattern.
It's a statistical artifact, not a stylistic choice by the AI.
And the result is that human writers who happen to use M-dashes, people like Daniel, people like me, frankly, are now getting their work flagged or questioned. I've seen editors asking writers to reduce M-dash usage because it looks AI-generated, which is absurd if you think about it for more than 5 seconds.
It's guilt by punctuation association. And it's doubly ironic because the M-dash is one of the most human marks. It conveys hesitation, interruption, the rhythm of actual speech. It's the opposite of mechanical.
Emily Dickinson used M-dashes constantly. She was not a language model. James Joyce, Virginia Woolf, David Foster Wallace, all heavy M-dash users. The mark has a long literary pedigree.
The perception has shifted. It's now a marker of suspicion in a way it never was before.
That's going to have downstream effects. If writers start avoiding M-dashes to dodge false AI accusations, the mark's usage in human writing will actually decline. The AI detection tail is wagging the stylistic dog.
I'd argue that's already happening. I've noticed myself second-guessing M-dashes in my own writing, which is infuriating because they serve a function that parentheses and commas don't quite cover.
What function do you think that is?
M-dashes interrupt. A parenthetical is an aside you're meant to register but not dwell on. It lowers the volume. An M-dash creates a break that demands attention. It's more dramatic, more conversational. If I'm writing something that's meant to sound like thought happening in real time, M-dashes are the right tool.
That's exactly the distinction. And commas can't do the same work because they're too lightweight. They don't create enough separation. A comma between two independent clauses is often just a grammatical error waiting to happen.
We're potentially losing a useful mark because of a statistical quirk in AI training data.
Which brings us back to Daniel's broader question about contraction. We're living through another period of punctuation change right now, and it's being driven by technology, just like the printing press and the typewriter drove change in their eras.
What other marks are shifting right now?
The period at the end of a text message has become aggressive. There's actual research on this. A study from Binghamton University in 2015 found that text messages ending with a period are perceived as less sincere, more abrupt, even angry.
I've felt this. If someone texts me okay with no period, it's neutral. If they text, okay. With a period, I assume they're upset about something.
That's a genuine linguistic change happening in real time. The period, which was the first punctuation mark ever invented, is acquiring a new, pragmatic meaning in digital contexts. It's no longer just a neutral full stop. It carries emotional weight.
The exclamation point has shifted too. It used to indicate genuine excitement or emphasis. Now it's often a politeness marker, thanks, where the unadorned version reads as curt.
The ellipsis has been completely repurposed by older generations in ways that confuse younger readers. When someone over 50 writes, "I'll see you there," they often mean it as a neutral trailing off. Younger readers interpret it as passive-aggressive or ominous.
There's a genuine generational punctuation gap. I've seen email threads where the punctuation choices alone cause miscommunication.
None of this is being dictated by grammarians or style guides. It's emerging organically from millions of daily interactions, the same way punctuation originally emerged from the needs of orators and scribes.
Let's circle back to the history for a moment. You mentioned the question mark earlier, but I want to dig into its origin story specifically. Where did that symbol actually come from?
The leading theory is that it evolved from the Latin word quaestio, meaning question. Scribes would write quo at the end of an interrogative sentence as an abbreviation. Over time, the Q migrated above the O, and the shapes merged and stylized into the curly symbol we use today. So the question mark is literally a compressed word.
That's remarkably efficient. Two letters collapsing into a single mark over centuries of handwriting.
The exclamation point has a similar origin story. It likely comes from the Latin io, an exclamation of joy. Scribes wrote the I above the O, and the combination eventually became the mark we recognize.
Both of our sentence terminal marks are medieval emoji, essentially. Compressed emotional expressions.
That's not a bad way to think about it. And the ampersand, the and sign, is a ligature of the letters E and T from the Latin et. If you look closely at some ampersand designs, you can still see the E and the T.
The ampersand has had an interesting trajectory. It was once considered a letter of the alphabet. Literally, the 27th letter. School children in the early 19th century would recite the alphabet ending with XYZ and per se and why? The phrase and per se and got slurred into ampersand.
Which is one of my favorite etymologies in all of English. A whole word was born from children reciting the alphabet, and the ampersand itself has survived while other ligatures died out. You don't see the QT ligature or the SS ligature in modern English text, but the ampersand persists.
What about quotation marks? Those feel like they should have an interesting history.
They do, and it's surprisingly recent. Quotation marks, as we know them, the double inverted commas, emerged in the late 17th century. Before that, writers indicated quoted speech in various ways, underlining, marginal notes, different typefaces. The dipple, a carrot-like mark in the margin, was used in medieval manuscripts to indicate something noteworthy, but it wasn't a quotation mark in the modern sense.
When did quotation marks become standardized?
The 18th century, alongside the rest of the punctuation system. But there's a persistent transatlantic divide. American English uses double quotation marks for primary quotes and single for nested quotes. British English traditionally does the reverse. And neither system is more logical. They're just conventions that happen to crystallize differently.
I've always found it strange that we use the same mark for opening and closing in most typefaces. Curly quotes solve that, but straight quotes don't.
Again, blame the typewriter. Straight quotes were a space-saving compromise. A single key for both open and close, for both single and double quotes, and for the apostrophe. Four functions, one key.
The typewriter really did a number on typographic richness.
It did, and we're only now recovering some of what was lost. Modern word processors can auto-convert straight quotes to curly quotes, insert proper M dashes, handle ellipses as single characters. The technical capacity is there. But the cultural knowledge, knowing when and why to use these marks, is eroding.
That's an interesting tension. We have more typographic capability than ever before, but probably less punctuation literacy than a century ago.
I think that's fair. And it connects to something Daniel hinted at, the idea that punctuation is partly idiosyncratic, that there can be multiple correct ways to punctuate the same sentence. That's true, but it's also true that the range of acceptable variation has narrowed over time.
Because of style guides?
Style guides, education systems, and now grammar checking software. If you write in Microsoft Word or Google Docs, the software is constantly nudging you toward a particular punctuation style. It flags missing commas, suggests removing unnecessary punctuation, and generally enforces a fairly narrow view of correctness.
Which is probably making our punctuation more uniform over time.
And that's not entirely bad. Consistency helps readability, but it does mean we're losing some of the expressive range that punctuation can provide.
Let's talk about an example of that expressive range. The semicolon in particular. You mentioned it's been controversial forever. Why does it provoke such strong feelings?
I think because it's the most visibly writerly mark. A period, or a comma, is invisible to most readers. But a semicolon signals that the writer made a deliberate choice. And for some readers, that signal reads as pretension rather than precision.
Vonnegut's college comment basically accuses semicolon users of showing off.
There's a class dimension to that criticism that doesn't get discussed much. The semicolon is associated with formal education, with academic writing, with a certain kind of literary prestige. Rejecting it is partly a rejection of those institutions.
Which is ironic, given that the semicolon was invented by a commercial printer trying to sell books.
It wasn't born in a university. It was born in a Venetian print shop, but it acquired cultural baggage over centuries.
Do you use semicolons in your own writing?
I do, but selectively. I think the semicolon is best when it connects two clauses that are in tension or conversation with each other, where the relationship between the thoughts matters. If you're just using it to avoid a period, it's probably the wrong choice.
That's a good heuristic. Use the semicolon when the connection between ideas is the point.
That's actually a good general principle for punctuation. Each mark should do work that another mark can't do as well. If you can replace your M dash with a comma and lose nothing, you probably don't need the M dash.
We've covered the history, the contraction, the cultural shifts. Let's address Daniel's question about whether punctuation marks emerge gradually or all at once.
The answer is definitively gradually from multiple sources. The period, comma, and colon trace back to Aristophanes in Alexandria. Word spacing came from Irish monks. The semicolon from a Venetian printer. The question mark and exclamation point evolved from Latin abbreviations. Quotation marks emerged in the 17th century, the M dash in the 18th. And we're still inventing new marks. The interrobang in the 1960s, the sarcasm tilde in internet culture, the hashtag which has become a kind of meta-punctuation.
The hashtag is an interesting case. It started as a technical marker on Twitter and has evolved into a genuine rhetorical device. You can use a hashtag to indicate tone, to undermine your own statement, to add a layer of irony.
Pound sign becomes metadata tag becomes rhetorical punctuation. That's a new thing in the history of written language.
Emoji are arguably a form of punctuation, too. They're not replacing words. They're adding paralinguistic information the way tone of voice does in speech.
There's a serious argument that emoji are the first major expansion of the punctuation system in centuries. They do what the percontation point and the irony mark were trying to do, convey emotional and tonal information that plain text misses.
The contraction may be reversing. We lost a bunch of marks in the 18th and 19th centuries, and now we're inventing new ones again.
But there's an important difference. The old marks were standardized through print. The new marks are emerging through networked digital communication, and they're not being codified by any central authority. It's a more organic, more chaotic process.
Which is actually closer to how punctuation originally evolved, through the practices of individual scribes and printers, not through top-down standardization.
We're returning to a medieval model of punctuation evolution, just at internet scale and speed.
Before we wrap up, I want to touch on one more thing, the relationship between punctuation and breath. You mentioned that the earliest marks were for orators managing their breathing. Do you think there's still a connection between punctuation and the physical experience of language?
When I'm writing, I'm subvocalizing. I can feel where the pauses go, where the intonation rises. Punctuation is a way of notating that internal voice. And when punctuation is wrong, you can feel it physically. The sentence doesn't breathe right.
That's why reading your own writing aloud is so revealing. The places where you stumble are almost always punctuation problems.
There's neuroscience behind this. Reading activates the same brain regions as speech production, even when you're reading silently. Punctuation is part of how the brain simulates the spoken voice. A period triggers a brief neural pause. A question mark triggers a rise in simulated intonation.
Punctuation isn't just a visual convention. It's mapping onto something deep in how we process language.
Which is why the history of punctuation matters. These marks aren't arbitrary decorations. They're the residue of centuries of humans trying to capture voice on a page. Every comma is a breath, every period is a silence, every question mark is a rising tone. The technology of writing has changed, but the underlying problem, how do you encode a living voice in dead marks, is the same one Aristophanes was trying to solve 2,000 years ago.
That's a good place to land. Punctuation is fossilized speech.
I like that.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
During the interwar period, katabatic wind patterns over the Drake Passage were clocked at velocities sufficient to displace an estimated 1.3 million metric tons of surface water per second during peak outflow events.
1.3 million metric tons per second. That's not a wind. That's a freight train made of air.
I don't even know what to do with that number.
Here's the forward-looking thought. Daniel's M-dash problem is a preview of something bigger. As AI-generated text becomes more common, the markers we use to judge authenticity, punctuation, word choice, sentence structure, are all going to shift. We're going to have to figure out what human writing even means when the statistical fingerprints keep changing. That's not just a punctuation problem, that's an epistemology problem.
The history suggests we'll figure it out messily over decades with a lot of wrong turns. But we'll figure it out. We always have.
Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. This has been My Weird Prompts. Find us at myweirdprompts.com or wherever you get your podcasts. We'll be back with another one soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.